Case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 865963, Ray Taylor versus Illinois. Mr. Cunningham, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the issue in this case is whether the state's use of a preclusion sanction as to relevant probative testimony of a defense witness in order to enforce its discovery rules violated the compulsory process clause of the Sixth Amendment. On the second day of a four-day jury trial, defense counsel sought to amend his list of witnesses to include the witness Alfred Wormley. The trial judge reserved his ruling on this request until the following morning. At that time, the court ordered that the witness testify under oath as an offer of proof outside the presence of the jury. The witness's testimony was subjected to cross-examination by both the prosecutor and the court. After hearing this testimony and arguments, the court found that there had been a blatant and willful violation of the discovery rules. The court ordered that the witness be precluded from testifying, stating, "I feel that defense attorneys have been violating discovery in this courtroom in the last three or four cases blatantly, and I am going to put a stop to it, and this is one way to do so." He further remarked that he was considering reporting the defense attorney to the disciplinary commission, and that he didn't think that any attorney should violate any orders purposely to get an edge for his client. It is our position that the court's exclusion of the witness was arbitrary, and that it violated the Sixth Amendment. Although there is a serious question as to whether preclusion sanction would ever be constitutionally permissible, all parties are in agreement at the very least that before the sanction may be employed, a balancing test must be used to determine whether the state's interest in using preclusion outweighs the defendant's right to present his defense witnesses. The balancing test we urge this court to adopt is the one that has been employed by the vast majority of lower courts addressing this issue. That test begins with a presumption against exclusion of otherwise admissible defense evidence. The presumption is required because the integrity of the judicial system depends on full and fair disclosure of the defendant's version of the facts as well as the state's, so that the jury may decide where the truth lies.
Well, the integrity of the system depends to a certain extent, too, on complying with rules of court requiring you to give lists of witnesses.
That's correct, Your Honor, and we have to look to the intent of the discovery rules. The main intent of the discovery rules is to prevent surprise for the other party. And when the rule has not been complied with, we feel that the effect of the proper steps that a court should take is to see that the other party be made whole in terms of surprise, so that there are...
What, would that be a continuance?
It would depend on the circumstances of the case, Your Honor.
Certainly the prosecution never wants a continuance in a criminal case. A continuance is usually almost entirely for the benefit of the defendant.
Well, I would point out in that regard that in Illinois, when there's a long line of cases that where the state has violated the discovery rules and seeks to now put what could be termed a surprise witness before the court, if the defendant simply objects and asks for preclusion and the court then admits the testimony, on appeal, the defendant does not have a right. He has waived his right to appeal if he has not requested a continuance, because the courts in Illinois hold that that is conclusive evidence that the defendant was not prejudiced by the admission of the testimony, since the defendant did not even indicate that he needed a continuance to prepare for that witness's testimony. What I'm saying is that I'm not saying that a continuance in every case would be the proper remedy. Certainly in the instant case, I don't think the state even needed a continuance here. Once it heard what the witness's testimony was going to be, it then had before it It had before it. It knew what witnesses it needed in order to rebut that
testimony. So you're saying, in effect, you could flagrantly, as the trial court found, violate the rules of the court, and nothing would happen.
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that
the rest. At worst, you'd get thrown into the briar patch. That is, you'd get a continuance.
I'm not saying that either, Your Honor. Again, it would depend on each case. I certainly believe, again, to get back to the facts of this case, no continuance was required at all in order to make the state whole. The state, the Illinois discovery rules, I might point out, provide that a continuance is one of the remedies. But another remedy is that the other party be made, be put on notice as to what the material is that needs to be discovered. In this case, we had the perfect remedy. We had the state hearing under oath what the testimony of that witness was going to be. We had the state able to cross-examine that witness.
Other witnesses to impeach that witness.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if you look
that would have required a continuance, wouldn't it?
Not in this case, Your Honor. In this case, the witness testified that he had observed and heard the state witnesses plotting to go after Ray Taylor in this case, and that he had observed the state witnesses with pistols. Those were the very witnesses present at court that day testifying for the state.
Now, what about getting other people to come in and say this man is a congenital liar? Other people who knew this witness.
Well, Your Honor, if the prosecution believed that they had other evidence that needed to be investigated, they could request a continuance. But our argument,
the only way to get that sort of evidence would have been a continuance.
Well, our argument here, Your Honor, is that the burden should be on the state. The state is seeking to preclude the defendant from presenting a witness. That is a constitutional right provided to the defendant.
If we're in violation of the rules and the burden is on the state, that seems
we believe the burden is on the state, Your Honor, because it is the state that is seeking to preclude the witness from testifying. Now, as the rules themselves provide, exclusion is not the only remedy. The committee comments to the rules note that there might be constitutional problems if the defense was precluded from presenting a witness.
Suppose you come up the day of trial with hearsay testimony, and the judge says, I'm not going to let this in because it's hearsay. Would you make the argument, well, it's important evidence. You have to give me a continuance so I can go and get the fellow who really said it, so it won't be hearsay anymore. You wouldn't expect to get a continuance for that, would you?
You simply
violated the rules of the game by trying to introduce hearsay evidence, which is not reliable enough, and the court says, I'm sorry, we're going to move ahead.
Well, Your Honor,
you expect a continuance to be able to go and get the original declarer?
My answer is that the court should endeavor to ensure that the defense is able to present its witnesses.
And in hearsay case, you would expect a continuance.
Well, it would depend on if the defense had never gotten a continuance in the past, and if it was only going to be a one-day continuance. I think it would be an abuse of the court's discretion and a violation of the Constitution to not grant that continuance.
Mr. Cunningham, what do you do at the point that the judge says, you've been doing this over and over and over again, I've got to stop it?
Well, that is exactly what the judge said here, not to that counsel personally, but he said it had been happening in his courtroom over and over. Our position.
Yeah, I read it. He was talking about that lawyer.
Well, he said this has happened in three or four other cases. I don't think he was speaking about that counsel. There's no indication of the record he was. He mentioned that it had happened in other cases previously. Our position is the remedy that he contemplated and then abandoned would be the appropriate remedy in that case, and that is that he said he was considering reporting the attorney to the disciplinary commission. We feel the disciplinary sanctions of the attorney is the appropriate remedy where the court is seeking to deter other attorneys from failing to comply with discovery rules. The balancing
test would be different constitutionally if instead of the attorney it was the defendant himself who had just not brought forth this witness until the last minute because he's afraid he might have been intimidated, or maybe he intimidated the witness and didn't want to identify him until right before trial.
I think the case may well be different, Your Honor. There are other factors to consider, too, but the case, it could well be that if the defendant himself was the one who had brought about this delay purposely in order to inject what appeared to be perjured testimony. If you combine that with evidence in the record that the state was going to be prejudiced, was not going to be able to be prepared through the use of other sanctions, then perhaps the preclusion sanction would be appropriate. We certainly don't have that.
You do not take the position that the preclusion sanction is never appropriate.
We have taken that position in our brief. And
you just seem to be abandoning it.
We have taken that, and we're taking as our second position that even if it is not appropriate, that a balancing test must be employed in which there is a presumption against preclusion.
But your more extreme position, that it's never an appropriate sanction, would require us to even allow the defendant to play games with the court.
Well, as I pointed out, one in Wainwright, Braswell v. Wainwright, the Fifth Circuit suggested that perhaps if it was so flagrant, that could be construed as a knowing and intelligent waiver by the defendant of his Sixth Amendment right to present witnesses. And that would be approached.
You're saying this kind of waiver could not be made on behalf of the defendant by his counsel?
No, Your Honor. I believe that the recent Second Circuit opinion in Escalera v. Coombe and the Ninth Circuit opinion in Fenler v. Goldsmith are correct on this point, that it's fundamentally unfair to put upon the defendant, an innocent defendant, his counsel's bad faith in this situation. Because another reason for that would be, as this Court recognized recently in Rock v. Arkansas, in citing Ferretta v. California, that this Court noted that the right to compulsory process is a personal right to the defendant, and it's not a right of counsel. The test which we propose begins with a presumption against exclusion of otherwise admissible defense evidence. The presumption is required because the integrity of the judicial process, well, I'm sorry, I've mentioned it. The denial of the defendant's right calls into question the ultimate integrity of the fact-finding process and requires that the competing interest be closely examined. Maximum truth-gathering rather than arbitrary limitation ought to be the goal. Put another way, the presumption against exclusion puts the burden on the state to demonstrate a compelling interest which requires the denial of the right.
It sounds to me like the inquisitorial system, not the adversarial system which we have. I mean, you have a system in which each side...
Exactly, and that is the truth-gathering system I'm referring to, that both sides ought to be able to present their full case.
Subject to certain rules, and sometimes you break a rule, like if you try to introduce evidence that is unreliable because it's hearsay, it's simply excluded.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And here what the Court was saying is this evidence is unreliable because it hasn't been subjected to the testing process that our requirements of advance notice provide for. Since it's unreliable, I'm excluding this.
No, the Court, that was not the basis for the Court's ruling. I mean, I read the basis for the main basis for the Court's ruling was to act as a deterrent in other cases.
So that the system would work in other cases, and advance notice and ability to check out witnesses would occur in those cases.
But if that test is going to be applied, if it's going to be almost a per se preclusion every time the defense violates discovery such as it did in this case, then we're not recognizing any longer the importance of the Sixth Amendment right.
Well, the Sixth Amendment right is subject, as Justice Scalia suggests, to rules of evidence. A defendant cannot simply come up with any piece of evidence he feels is relevant and say, look, the Sixth Amendment guarantees me the right to place this before the jury. It's all subject to an elaborate system of rules.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I don't think the rules take precedence over the right. Certainly the right is above it. But in any event, I think when anyone is seeking, as the state was seeking here, to abridge that right, the burden has to be on the state to show that there are no other remedies to make the state whole. And here the state has totally failed to do that. It never argued in the trial court that it was not prepared to meet Mr. Wormley's testimony once it had heard that testimony. And our argument is that the burden is on the state. If it is seeking to abridge the Sixth Amendment right, it has to demonstrate that there is a compelling interest on the other side for the abridgment. To do that, the state had to show that it could not have met that testimony. There were other effective remedies that would have fully met the intent of the discovery rules here.
Mr. Cunningham, may I inquire, please, when the compulsory process claim was presented to the courts below?
There was an exception taken in the trial court, and it was noted in the post-trial motion. In the appellate court...
Well, but never under the rubric of a compulsory process claim.
That's correct. In the appellate court, the state is arguing that this court does not have jurisdiction on the ground that the issue we raised below is a different issue than the one we're raising here.
And it did seem to be. I just wondered if you had any comment.
Yes, I do. The state does not question that we preserved a due process claim.
Right.
In the appellate court, we cited the due process clause. We did not, in our original appellate brief, we did not specifically cite either the Sixth Amendment or the compulsory process clause. However, we did cite Washington v. Texas and Chambers v. Mississippi, two compulsory process clause cases as our main authority, along with an Illinois case, People v. Rayford, which the Solicitor General has agreed is a compulsory process case. Our position is that the case law of this court makes clear that the question is whether the substance of the federal claim below is the same as the substance of the federal claim presented here, and our position is that it was. We did, in fact, cite the Sixth Amendment in our rehearing petition to the appellate court, and then we cited it in our petition for leave to appeal to the Supreme Court. But as I said, the case law makes it clear that it's a question of the substance of the federal claim, and we didn't have to cite book and verse on the Constitution. We did properly preserve the claim by citing the Due Process Clause.
But it is true. But you didn't really make a constitutional argument to the trial judge at the time of his ruling. You didn't say that
at the time of his ruling, the defense attorney did not, but the state has not contested that. There was no issue raised in the appellate brief that the issue had been waived, certainly, and when I orally argued the case, there was no question.
What I'm really suggesting is, I'm not suggesting technically there isn't jurisdiction, but you're in effect saying that the trial judge committed constitutional error because he didn't do a balancing test that he was never asked to perform. The trial lawyer never said, well, you've got to balance my interests against the other.
Your Honor, our position is that it is not the burden of the client to impose upon the court that balancing test. The court has that duty.
In doing the balancing, under your view, would the judge's doubts about the credibility of the witness be a factor that he could weigh? And here the judge did express such doubts.
He said, for what it's worth, he expressed some doubt about a portion of the credibility.
Part of his testimony is inherently probable.
No, Your Honor, it's our position that the credibility of the witnesses is for the jury to determine. This court has made that clear time and time again in Rock v. Arkansas and Chambers v. Mississippi and Washington v. Texas.
Error.
Well, Your Honor.
I mean, if one were to find that true, that there may have been a violation of a confrontation clause, say in a hypothetical case, but the witness's testimony was so tangential or so minor, it couldn't possibly have affected the outcome. Certainly that sort of a review for harmless error would be permissible, wouldn't it?
I don't believe in the trial court that should be permissible, frankly, but I believe that certainly there's a harmless error analysis to any of these cases, I would agree. We certainly don't
have an appellate court reviewing your claim could say, true, there was a violation of the confrontation or of the compulsory process clause, but it was just harmless error.
No question about that. But the standard would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, as it is in Schnebel v. Florida. In this case, though, to get to the balancing test, if we can for a moment, keeping in mind that there should be a presumption against preclusion in applying the test.
And also a presumption in favor of the rule.
Your Honor, the rule we're talking
You've
about...
You've got two presumptions here. One is the rule is good unless you say it's bad. And you have to prove it's bad.
The rule that we're
so
talking
you're
about...
you're going to put the burden on the state to prove that it's good. How do you do that?
The Illinois statute, the Illinois discovery statutes do not require preclusion, Your Honor. The Illinois statute
the
has...
The judge does.
Well, that's our argument,
that's
Your Honor. That would be a mechanistic approach. That would be a totally arbitrary rule to just exclude every time the defense violates discovery. To exclude the witness would be a mechanistic approach. And as I say, there's a long line of Illinois cases where the state violates the rule, where if the defendant only objects and asks for preclusion and the judge goes forward and allows the witness to testify, the courts on appeal then hold that there's no error. They hold that because the defense failed to ask for a continuance, that is conclusive proof that there's no prejudice.
The defendant didn't ask for that in this case.
No, it was the state who failed to ask for a continuance or failed to demonstrate in any manner that it was going to be prejudiced in this case.
Well, the defendant had no responsibility at all.
Your Honor, to put it on the defendant would be very difficult because he doesn't know what position the state is in terms of prejudice. The defendant would not be able to articulate to the court why it is that the state is not prejudiced or why it is that the state does not need a continuance. It is up to the state who is seeking to preclude. If you look at the colloquy, it was the state arguing very strongly that this witness should be precluded because of a flagrant violation of discovery. It should have been the state's burden to articulate to the court why it was that lesser sanctions were not appropriate.
The burden, I don't see where you shift the burden there. I think the burden, of course, is on the state to prove its case.
Well, I think if
there's
we maybe...
There's also a shift in responsibility when the rules say you should do this and you don't do
it. But
this.
I think we should look at the intent of the rules. The rules are not just set up to be applied in a mechanistic fashion. The rules are set up to ensure that neither party will be surprised, that both parties can prepare for the testimony of the other side's witnesses. So I think the question...
There's really more than that at stake, it seems to me. There are also, in every case, if right on, when you get your witnesses in the courtroom, you got the jury in the box, and you're all ready to go, and then something like this happens, and there's a request for a continuance, automatically there's prejudice to the whole process if you have to send everybody home and you don't know whether you get the witnesses back 3 days later. There's inherently prejudice in every case with a last-minute continuance, isn't there?
Well, it's
and
difficult for me
fact,
to...
You've got to verify
I mean, again,
the
I think
story.
I think we have to, you know, maybe measure what the quantum of prejudice is when you say that in every continuance there's prejudice. There are continuances in jury trials in Cook County day after day after day after day, and in the middle of trials, too, I might add.
I think
we have to take a realistic view. I mean, the point is that the defense is being precluded from presenting relevant probative testimony, as it was done in this case. And I think you have to weigh that against whatever prejudice there will be. What the point I'm trying to make is that in this particular case, the witnesses needed to rebut Mr. Wormley's testimony. Maybe if I could briefly discuss what the testimony was. The issue in this case was a credibility question of who shot the complaining witness, Jack Bridges. The state's witnesses were Jack Bridges and his three relatives. They stated that Ray Taylor had shot him during a fight that Mr. Bridges and his relatives were having with Ray Taylor and his friends. The defense presented two eyewitnesses to the event who testified that Ray Taylor was not armed during the event, that it was Jack Bridges' brother who fired shots into the crowd trying to protect Jack Bridges and who shot Jack Bridges. Mr. Wormley, also, I might add that Bridges and Bethany, his brother, had both testified that they were unarmed on that night. Mr. Wormley, the excluded witness, would have testified that prior to the incident, sometime earlier in the evening, he had joined a group of people, including Jack Bridges and his family, on the porch of Bridges' sister. He had observed Bridges handing a blanket containing two pistols to his girlfriend. He had further overheard Bridges and his family discussing how they were going to go after Ray Taylor. Now, this testimony was very crucial to the defense. Number one, it corroborated the other two witnesses, and it was an independent source of corroboration in that it occurred at a different time and a different location. Number two, it directly rebutted the testimony of Bridges and Bethany that they were unarmed on that night. And number three, it added an element to the defense's case which was totally lacking, and that is the element of planned aggression on the part of Bridges and his family. So this testimony was crucial to the defense. Now, once the state had heard all that testimony and the offer of proof, they were no longer surprised. That is definitely, and surprise is the main thing we're looking to overcome. At that point, they were no longer surprised. Also, I might add, in that point of the trial, there were still the three of the state witnesses to be presented and all of the defense to be presented. The trial did not end until the following day. So at that point, the state basically knew the witnesses it needed to rebut Mr. Wormley's testimony. They needed the complaining witness and his family, who were all present there. Now, if from talking to them they felt they needed additional witnesses, then they could inform the court as to what they needed and how much time they needed, and then perhaps the court could make a determination as to whether that would be so prejudicial to the state to have to grant a continuance at that time that he would consider precluding the witness. But absent any showing at all that the state was going to be prejudiced, we feel that this court must find that there was a violation of the Sixth Amendment.
To take once again the application of your Sixth Amendment theory to hearsay, if Wormley wasn't present, but you tried to introduce someone who said, well, Wormley isn't here, but Wormley told me that he saw thus and so, affirming your client's version of the fact. You think the court could not just immediately say, I'm sorry, we have a rule against hearsay evidence because we think it's not...
I think we'd have to look at the other factors.
Every case, case by case.
I think so, case by case. I think,
No absolute rule excluding hearsay. You have to say, well, let's see, maybe we'll have to have a continuance So you can go get the original declarant, go get Wormley.
Yes, I wasn't saying that they could admit the hearsay. I wasn't suggesting that.
No, you're just saying that you're entitled to a continuance.
No, I'm saying you would have to look at it case by case. If the defense had been causing a lot of continuances, if the continuance in that case, if it could be shown, would severely prejudice the state, then perhaps
the judge just couldn't say, look at you, today's the trial date. You know what the rules of evidence are. You should have been here with your evidence. If your counsel is so bad that he's tried to get in hearsay when he should have had the original declarant, if it's such a bad mistake that it amounts to ineffective assistance, you can have that relief, but this trial is going ahead. A judge couldn't say that.
Perhaps he could, Your Honor. That is not the case we have here. Here we have...
But it is the same principles that you're urging under the Sixth Amendment, that the rules designed to assure the reliability of evidence do not have to be absolutely followed. But in each case, the court is supposed to weigh whether bending them in this case or allowing a continuance so that they can be remedied will be in the interest of justice. That's basically what you're saying.
Well, that's true. I think that... I mean, the interesting thing here is that unlike Chambers or Washington or Rock, we don't have a case here where the reason the state was seeking to preclude the evidence was that they believed that the evidence was inherently unreliable. And I think that's what makes this such a stronger case than those other cases. Here we have a witness prepared to testify, a competent witness who could give relevant evidence of matters that he observed. There's no question of inherent unreliability whatsoever. The only question is whether or not the state could be prepared to meet that evidence.
How can you say there's no question of reliability if the state says one of the reasons why we want you to identify your witnesses in advance is so the other side will have a chance to do the investigation that's necessary to determine their credibility?
What I'm saying
is designed in part for reliability purposes.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that there are other remedies for the state to be made whole so that they would be put into that position. In this particular
case, there are
the
same other remedies in the hearsay example.
Well, let me give an example, Your Honor. If the defense had complied with discovery in this case and had given the witness's name to the state, the witness would have had no obligation to talk to the state whatsoever.
Oh, of course not. But they could at least have found out who he was.
So they would have known who he was.
Whether he was at the scene, and I guess he was not on the Currents witness.
But instead of that, what the state got was they got his full testimony under oath.
Yes, but...
So what I'm saying is that there are other remedies, other less severe remedies, that we feel are appropriate, certainly in this case, and to impose a preclusion sanction here would be an arbitrary...
Does the state have no right to depose a listed witness?
Not in Illinois.
Illinois.
No. If you have no other questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cunningham. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Chabot.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the position of the State of Illinois in this proceeding is that when a defendant, as Petitioner Taylor did in this case, sought to compel witnesses to attend court, he did so, understandably, in an effort present evidence to a jury, which was going to decide his guilt or his innocence. In the course of doing that, or the attempt to do so, it's incumbent upon defendants as well as prosecutors in this country to do so with compliance with established procedures, procedures which we submit assure fairness and reliability in the ascertainment of guilt and innocence. It is not merely the element of surprise that discovery rules address.
Mr. Chabot, may I ask,
yes,
is there any evidence that the defendant was personally involved in this noncompliance with the discovery rule, or is it just the lawyer who was responsible?
Your Honor, the record reflects that at the time during trial, after the jury had been selected, after opening statements by both the state and the defense, and after two of the state's key witnesses had testified on both direct and cross-examination, that The court sent the jury home until the next day. And at that time, the defense attorney stated that he had just learned of an additional witness who could have and probably did see the entire incident. The suggestion implicit in that.
Yes, but my question was the defendant personally involved in the noncompliance?
I suggest that it can be inferred that when he learned, when the defense attorney is telling the court that he learned, although we don't know directly and specifically, we can only infer that he learned it from his client who was sitting there at counsel table.
And the answer to my question is there's no evidence that the defendant personally was involved in this.
There is no direct evidence of that. That is correct. In the attempt to avoid surprise, we're really talking about more than that, because we're talking about an effort to assure fairness, reliability, and the ascertainment of guilt and innocence. To the extent that the Sixth Amendment may be implicated in that, or notions of due process, it does not permit a defendant to present testimony that's free from legitimate demands. The discovery rules in Illinois, in the specific instance, demands of an adversary system, because there really is no justification for a defendant under the guise of any constitutional right to attempt to assert half-truths. Now,
you,
of course,
I take it then that you're saying that preclusion is automatically justified in every single case of noncompliance.
No, sir. That is not our position. Preclusion, under our discovery rules in Illinois and in most of the states, and almost all of the states have such rules, preclusion is an option. It is an option among other options which a judge, in his discretion, can, must use, and did in fact use in this case.
That may be the state rule, but is it your position that the Sixth Amendment would never, never forbid preclusion?
No.
Sometimes.
There are circumstances.
What are they? Just name one.
I think that it would involve a circumstance where the nature of the violation, for example, being one that was fairly technical. If, for example, discovery had to be completed within a given jurisdiction after a number of days, but in any event, well before the parties intended to go to trial.
Would the Sixth Amendment ever forbid preclusion where there is a failure to reveal a name of a witness in compliance with the rule?
It might, after a determination by the judge of all the factors, such as the reason, the motivation behind the failure.
You think there's a balancing process that must go on in every case?
Most certainly, Your Honor. I believe that is appropriate.
Same in hearsay, of course, right? Same with hearsay. Because, the Sixth Amendment applies to that, too, right?
Well, no, I don't believe so. I believe that we have a different situation there. We have unreliable evidence in that instance, and I don't believe that the Sixth Amendment...
You were telling us that part of the purpose of this rule is that if there hasn't been the time to investigate the witness, the evidence is unreliable. I thought
yes.
That's part of your case.
In this case, that's right.
Well, just in this case. Not generally, under these rules.
No. Prosecutors must have an opportunity to fully investigate their case. It is not sufficient for a prosecutor to have to sit at trial after having prepared his case and investigated the evidence, having selected a jury, I might add, with a mind towards the type of witnesses that will be presented during the case.
Mr. Chavez, suppose in this case, instead of saying what he did to the judge, as I understand what you told us, the defense counsel said was, I've just learned.
Yes.
Suppose he had gone to the judge and said, Judge, I've made an awful boner here. It's not my client's fault. I've known about this witness, and I forgot to put it down, and that's why I didn't comply with the discovery rule, and I don't think my client should be penalized by denying him his right under the Sixth Amendment in those circumstances. What would you do with a case like that?
I would have to weigh that factor, Your Honor, with due regard to the other factors present in the case, such as when does this occur?
Oh, just when it occurred here.
Well, that's essentially what the defense lawyer tried to say, because on the very next page, after he has just indicated that he just learned of this witness, he sort of retracts that, and he says on page 206 of the record at the joint appendix, page 13, the defendant told me about him some time ago, but I couldn't locate him. Of course, that doesn't relieve him of an obligation. All he had to do was write down the name, address unknown, and that would have satisfied Illinois discovery.
Your position is just that the balancing was properly done here. You agree that there has to be balancing in every case?
Yes, sir. That is correct. And we are not at all suggesting that...
That's not much of a dispute, really, is it, between you and the other side? We took Your this Honor, case to decide whether the balancing was properly done in this case.
Well,
I thought we were going to talk about whether the balancing was necessary.
My opponent, I believe, is arguing that a preclusion is never appropriate. There is only one place that I have read within the documents filed in this court where the petitioner indicates that there might be a rare case where it could be appropriate, but he then imposes on the state some restrictions in that regard before they can avail themselves of that.
Didn't you argue we should overrule Washington against Texas?
It is,
seemed to me you took a little more extreme position in the brief.
In the brief submitted by the state of Illinois, we suggested that based on our historical analysis of the evolution, writing of the compulsory process clause, that perhaps Washington versus Texas should be reconsidered. Even if it were not to be reconsidered, it is our view that only arbitrary rules and procedures or statutes which interfere with a compulsory process clause run afoul of that clause. This is not an arbitrary procedure. The judge has discretion to choose this sanction, and it's not arbitrary because on its face the statute, the discovery rule, which provides sanctions here in Illinois, provides alternatives. So there is discretion inherent in the nature of the options available to the judge.
I suppose, let me change Justice Brennan's hypothetical a little. Suppose that the name of the witness was on the list counsel had prepared, but his secretary just omitted one name of 20. You'd come to the same conclusion, I take it.
It is possible. It would depend, again, the timing of that discovery and what inferences, if any, or what specific conclusions could be drawn after an examination of the attorney in court, whether it was designed as a strategic tactical advantage, an improper one, I might add, or whether, in fact, it was merely technical. And then I think would also
depend. The hypothetical I gave you was it was a sheer secretary's oversight.
That would certainly weigh in favor of not precluding.
Do you have in Illinois a notice of alibi rule?
Yes, and it's reciprocal as well.
And you would take the same position with respect to that you're taking here?
Yes, I would, Your Honor. In fact, back to Justice Brennan's question, when the defense attorney later changed his mind about what he knew, he indicated that he had been told some time ago about Alfred Wormley, this witness, but that he couldn't locate him. Well, the next day, at the judge's request, Alfred Wormley appeared in court. This was communicated to the defense attorney by the judge, and the defense attorney brought him to court the next day. And prior to the jury coming out to hear the third state's witnesses, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth, Alfred Wormley was voir dired. And it was during the course of that voir dire that we learn that, in fact, this defense attorney had visited Alfred Wormley, this newly discovered witness, at his home a week prior to the commencement of trial, a week before they picked that jury, a week before opening statements, a week and a day.
Sure, does it make any difference in the balancing how crucial the evidence is that the witness intends to give?
Yes, it can, and it should, because it is important.
How important was this evidence?
Not very, Your Honor. It is our position that although the defendant could argue that there is some conceivable benefit that could have been derived from this testimony, it certainly was not the kind of testimony which, having been excluded and reflecting upon the entire record, as we must do at this point, that one could conclude that this trial was unjust, that the verdict
Mr. Chabot,
somehow
you
compromised
believe,
by that.
If you believe that the victim was armed and his brother were both armed, or at least his brother, when they testified to the contrary and that the only gun was that of the defendant, that would, I mean, if you believe the man, it would really change the facts quite a bit.
Perhaps. The judge had an opportunity, although not the best opportunity, to observe the demeanor of this witness during that voir dire. In fact, he concluded that he didn't believe he was a very credible witness. And I think that the great weight should be placed on that, given these circumstances in this case. At most, yes, I believe that this test...
It perhaps really doesn't have anything to do with the issue, but I can't. Was this retained counsel, the defendant's counsel?
Yes.
Was this appointed counsel? It was retained counsel.
I believe it was, yes.
Does that answer the petitioner's repeated point about she could have gotten a postponement of a day or so? Do you think your last answer answers that?
Your Honor, I believe that a continuance would have been inappropriate in this case. First of all, I don't believe that an interruption of the trial at this stage of the proceedings is in the interest of justice and truth-seeking. The jury has been impaneled. The jury has heard opening statements. The jury has listened to the witness.
In Illinois, in Chicago, where they've interrupted in the middle of a trial, right? I assume so. It's every city I've ever heard of.
Most likely.
Yeah.
Hopefully not for this reason, though. But in any event, that doesn't advance the efforts of the participants in the justice system, mm-hmm. not the least of which is the judge, who has a tremendous caseload that he has to work through, that is being forestalled because of this kind of conduct. And once a jury is listening to evidence and they are in the state's case in chief, I think it is fair to conclude that delays that occur under those conditions do not advance the interests of the state, which desires to proceed witness after witness to conclusion of the state's case in chief.
You could have had the continuance come after the state's case in chief, couldn't you? Because Wormley wasn't going to be called until the defense case.
There's another aspect of that, Your Honor. Although, yes, that could have happened. I don't believe that would have been sufficient either. When the state prepares for trial, it does so with a thorough investigation of all of the witnesses, all of its witnesses, and an attempt to find out if they can't interview, because a witness doesn't have to talk to the state, nevertheless use its investigative resources to find out something about that witness in some detail, to see where that witness really was.
That doesn't happen in all criminal cases.
What's that?
Haven't you ever heard a criminal case where the lawyer says, well, you'd arrest an officer, will tell what happened?
That
doesn't assure the investigation.
Well, that's one that
is, if they waited 2 days or 1 day, there could have been a preliminary investigation, couldn't there? You've got an efficient police department.
Yes, I believe we do, but I don't believe that 1 or 2 days would have necessarily been sufficient time, and I also don't believe that in light of the fact that we are in the middle of a trial, where a jury has been listening to evidence, that the possibility of its losing its train of thought...
We all understand. Well, you don't have to keep saying in the middle of a trial. We know exactly what it means.
I think that is central to my argument, Your Honor. I think that it's imperative that things like this not come about as a surprise well past the 11th hour. I think that for that reason, with liberal discovery...
Well, let me ask you this, then.
Yes, sir.
If this happened on the first day, would you have... in favor of a postponement, a continuance?
If by the first day, Your Honor, I take your meaning to be prior to the selection of the jury, prior to opening statements?
Well, do you want this to be a case limited to the facts in this case?
No. No. I
but
believe...
If you don't want it limited to the facts in this case, then stop emphasizing these facts.
I have another problem relating the facts of this case. If this whole thing's been decided on a balancing test, as you say, shouldn't we require that the judge, in fact, conduct a balancing test? And what evidence do we have that he conducted any balancing test here? He didn't even receive an objection from the prosecution to the effect that we think this evidence is unreliable. We want to interview some witnesses. I mean, all of these great and serious reasons you're giving us now are brain spun. They weren't brought before the district judge at the time.
Your Honor, I believe, to the contrary, that we have a record here that shows that the judge was, if not specifically articulating any of the criteria that we have discussed today as part of his decision in deciding to preclude the witness, that he was fully cognizant of the options available to him. He also, by his deeds, did not only preclude a witness, Alfred Wormley, who was tendered, identified to the state when he was, but there is evidence in this record that prior to trial, before the first witness was called, but after jury selection, the defense asked leave of court to amend his list of witnesses in this case, and he was permitted to do so. And they were not excluded. What the judge did, however, in that instance was, I believe, a very measured and appropriate response from which I derive inference that he was conducting a balancing approach. He told the state that for those witnesses, before they were allowed to testify, time would be taken for the state to attempt to interview them. I think it shows a measured response which is an indication of his cognizance of why he was doing what he did and what was available to him beyond that which he did for any of the witnesses for whom discovery was an issue in this case. And I also believe that the judge was weighing in his mind, as evidenced by his words, the problem that he was confronting, that he had confronted, that other judges of the Circuit Court of Cook County had confronted in previous cases where surprise, ambush, defense tactics had been perpetrated upon the state. And I believe that a sense of his frustration is evidenced by this record. And it's clear to us that he was attempting to devise the appropriate sanction or remedy to be applied in each of the instances of belated discovery of witnesses to the state.
me ask you about this repetitious problem that happened over and over again. In your view, was the judge saying this is significant because it's a nuisance to the court to have to grant repeated continuances, or do you read him as saying that there is some problem about the risk that some unscrupulous lawyers may try to be fabricating false testimony?
Yes to both. I would answer yes to both of those questions.
I suppose if you look at it as the latter, as part of the problem, then the rather shabby behavior of this lawyer is relevant and perhaps partially attributable to his client.
Yes, it is. That is our position. We believe that, as the appellate court found in this case, under analysis under Strickland, that this defense attorney was competent. That issue was presented to the appellate court, and it was resolved in that manner. And indeed, he was competent. He presented pretrial motions. He argued them. He examined witnesses, some great length, and put on witnesses as well. This was not the kind of representation that one could ever argue was incompetent.
Practitioner, do you know?
I know that people from my generation in our felony trial courts were not familiar with him, but the newer people who are trying cases today in our felony trial courts were aware of his presence from time to time in our trial courts at 26th and California, Chicago.
You're saying that your generation didn't know him, but the younger generation did.
That's correct. That is correct.
40.
You only tried young cases or what? I don't know.
The obligation that was placed on the defendant in this case to comply with discovery was certainly not burdensome, and it wasn't very difficult. The answer to discovery is a simple document to prepare. It's what you have to be able to do to be able to prepare for trial. All the defense attorney had to do here was to respond to our motion. Even if he didn't know Wormley's address, Wormley would have testified had timely notice of his name been given. I believe that the value of compliance here, not just to the state, frankly, but to the criminal justice system, specifically here, the jury, in its attempt to ascertain the truth, was great. No surprise, no delay, state having an opportunity to fully investigate and thereby enhance the truth-seeking function at trial. We perceive the defendant's attempt here as an attempt to, in some way, insulate the exercise of his Sixth Amendment right and discovery rules from imposition of any legitimate demands of our adversary system. Our great concern, Your Honors, is that if he is successful here, he's going to effectively emasculate the intent of our discovery rules, rules which are designed for both sides, to afford both sides an enhanced opportunity to prepare their case, present their evidence. These discovery rules are liberal rules, and they are appropriately so. In Illinois, we virtually give our file in its entirety to the defendant before trial. Certainly, given that, it's not appropriate under due process or the Sixth Amendment for the defendant to be able to obtain an advantage if he can get everything and go to trial and present as a surprise, untested evidence, even though he's violated those rules. Defendant's violation of those rules were very flagrant here. I believe that the judge acted in a judicious, tempered, and balanced manner, a manner which did not affect the outcome of this trial, nor could it be said that the absence of Wormley's testimony, although there is perhaps a conceivable benefit that could have been derived from it, would nevertheless never have affected the integrity of the verdict. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shabbat. Mr. Cunningham, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Scalia, in answer to your question, which I never was able to get to, it's true that all parties, including the Solicitor General, agree that a balancing test must be applied. In this case, it clearly was never applied by the trial judge, unlike what was going on in Illinois since People v. Rayford in 1976. We ask that this court apply the balancing test, and if it does so, I think the defense will win the case.
It's been going on in Illinois since 1976. Why didn't anybody ask the trial judge in this court to do it?
Well, Your Honor, we have raised ineffective assistance of counsel. We raised it before this court, and this court chose to only accept the case on question one. So unlike the state says, we certainly argue ineffective assistance of counsel in this case. But again, the burden should be on the court to apply that balancing test in any event.
Well, do you think the balancing has to be articulated and made on the record?
No, Your Honor.
Or can the trial judge just think it through and weigh the pros and the cons and the prejudice and the
I think he could think it through, except that the evidence of prejudice would have to appear of record. And here we have no evidence that the state would have been prejudiced had Mr. Wormley been allowed to testify. Here we have no evidence that less severe sanctions would not have been appropriate. And in answer to another one of your questions about the materiality of the witness, yes, that is a part of the balancing test. And here I believe we've demonstrated that this witness was highly material. I might add that the jury went out to deliberate and came back and sent a message requesting the testimony of the complaining witness and his brother. It was not until after they had re-reviewed that testimony until they returned a verdict of guilt. This was a very close credibility case. As to the fact that the record is clear that Mr. Taylor was not responsible here for his attorney's at best negligence, there's no question about
that?
It.
How can you say it's clear? Maybe they didn't prove it, but how do you know?
Well, the state never argued that below.
The defendant never testified in the case, and you don't know what he said to his lawyer, what the lawyer said
to him? We do know that the lawyer said that the defendant had told him long before trial of the existence of Mr. Wormley, and we know that the lawyer interviewed Mr. Wormley at his home a week before trial and served him with a subpoena. I don't think on those facts it's at all fair to an uneducated criminal defendant, 20 years old, to put on to him that he somehow was aware of what these discovery rules were about.
The Supreme Court of the state thought that the trial judge did enough. It affirmed.
The Supreme Court denied the petition for leave to appeal.
The appellate court.
The appellate court affirmed. The appellate court
saying
might also...
a matter of discretion and finding no fault with what the judge did or said.
And the appellate court, again, totally failed to apply any kind of a balancing test at all. They simply said that preclusion was one of the sanctions permitted by the statute based on the flagrancy of the violation. We find no violation of the statute.
But in the appeal, counsel for your client wasn't arguing for a balance.
I was the appeal counsel for my client. I fully argued...
wasn't presented as a compulsory process claim.
Yes, it was, Your Honor. I argued the case of Enoch v. Hartigan to the appellate court, which is a Sixth Amendment case. I argued Washington v. Texas and Chambers v. Mississippi. I argued People v. Rayford, which the Solicitor General recognizes as a balancing test Sixth Amendment case. I made all those arguments to the appellate court, Your Honor. It's in our briefs, and I orally argued those arguments.
Thank you, Mr. Cunningham. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Tuesday next at 10 o'clock.